can have no recourse above or beyond what he sees with his eyes and instruments. If there were some higher authority by recourse to which his vision might be shown to have shifted, then that authority would itself become the source of his data, and the behavior of his vision would become a source of problems, as that of the experimental subject is for the psychologist. The same sorts of problems would arise if the scientist could switch back and forth, like the subject of the Gestalt experiments. The period during which light was sometimes a wave and sometimes a particle was a period of crisis, a period when something was wrong, and it ended only with the development of wave mechanics and the realization that light was a self-consistent entity different from both waves and particles. In the sciences, therefore, if perceptual switches accompany paradigm changes, we may not expect scientists to attest to these changes directly. Looking at the moon, the convert to Copernicanism does not say, "I used to see a planet, but now I see a satellite." That locution would imply a sense in which the Ptolemaic system had once been correct. Instead, a convert to the new astronomy says, "I once took the moon to be, or saw the moon as, a planet, but I was mistaken." That sort of statement does recur in the aftermath of scientific revolutions. If it ordinarily disguises a shift of scientific vision or some other mental transformation with the same effect, we may not expect direct testimony about that shift. Rather, we must look for indirect and behavioral evidence that the scientist with a new paradigm sees differently from the way he had seen before. Let us then return to the data and ask what sorts of transformations in the scientist's world the historian who believes in such changes can discover. Sir William Herschel's discovery of Uranus provides a first example, and one that closely parallels the anomalous card experiment. On at least 17 different occasions between 1690 and 1781, a number of astronomers, including several of Europe's most eminent observers, had seen a star in positions that we now suppose must have been occupied at the time by Uranus. One of the best observers in this group had actually seen the star on four successive nights in 1769, without noting the motion that could have suggested another identification. Herschel, when he first observed the same object 12 years later, did so with a much improved telescope of his own manufacture. As a result, he was able to notice an apparent disk size that was at least unusual for stars. Something was awry, and he therefore postponed identification pending further scrutiny. That scrutiny disclosed Uranus's motion among the stars, and Herschel therefore announced that he had seen a new comet. Only several months later, after fruitless attempts to fit the observed motion to a cometary orbit, did Lexell suggest that the orbit was probably planetary. When that suggestion was accepted, there were several fewer stars and one more planet in the world of the professional astronomer. A celestial body that had been observed off and on for almost a century was seen differently after 1781 because, like an anomalous playing card, it could no longer be fitted to the perceptual categories, star or comet, provided by the paradigm that had previously prevailed. The shift of vision that enabled astronomers to see Uranus, the planet, does not, however, seem to have affected only the perception of that previously observed object. Its consequences were more far-reaching. Probably, though the evidence is equivocal, the minor paradigm change forced by Herschel helped to prepare astronomers for the rapid discovery after 1801 of the numerous minor planets, or asteroids. Because of their small size, these did not display the anomalous magnification that had alerted Herschel. Nevertheless, astronomers prepared to find additional planets were able, with standard instruments, to identify 20 of them in the first 50 years of the 19th century. The history of astronomy provides many other examples of paradigm-induced changes in scientific perception some of them even less equivocal. Can it conceivably be an accident, for example, that Western astronomers first saw change in the previously immutable heavens during the half-century after Copernicus's new paradigm was first proposed? The Chinese, whose cosmological beliefs did not preclude celestial change, had recorded the appearance of many new stars in the heavens at a much earlier date. Also, even without the aid of a telescope, the Chinese had systematically recorded the appearance of sunspots, centuries before these were seen by Galileo and his contemporaries. Nor were sunspots and a new star the only examples of celestial change to emerge in the heavens of Western astronomy immediately after Copernicus. Using traditional instruments, some as simple as a piece of thread, late 16th century astronomers repeatedly discovered that comets wandered at will through the space previously reserved for the immutable planets and stars. The very ease and rapidity with which astronomers saw new things when looking at old objects with old instruments may make us wish to say that after Copernicus, astronomers lived in a different world. In any case, their research responded as though that were the case. The preceding examples are selected from astronomy because reports of celestial observation are frequently delivered in a vocabulary consisting of relatively pure observation terms. Only in such reports can we hope to find anything like a full parallelism between the observations of scientists and those of the psychologists' experimental subjects. But we need not insist on so full a parallelism, and we have much to gain by relaxing our standard. If we can be content with the everyday use of the verb to see, we may quickly recognize that we have already encountered many other examples of the shifts in scientific perception that accompany paradigm change. The extended use of perception and of seeing will shortly require explicit defense. But let me first illustrate its application in practice. Look again for a moment at two of our previous examples from the history of electricity. During the 17th century, when their research was guided by one or another effluvium theory, electricians repeatedly saw chaff particles rebound from or fall off the electrified bodies that had attracted them. At least that is what 17th century observers said they saw, and we have no more reason to doubt their reports of perception than our own. Placed before the same apparatus, a modern observer would see electrostatic repulsion rather than mechanical or gravitational rebounding, but historically, with one universally ignored exception, electrostatic repulsion was not seen as such until Hauksbee's large-scale apparatus had greatly magnified its effects. Repulsion after contact electrification was, however, only one of many new repulsive effects that Hauksbee saw. Through his researches, rather as in a Gestalt switch, repulsion suddenly became the fundamental manifestation of electrification, and it was then attraction that needed to be explained. The electrical phenomena visible in the early 18th century were both subtler and more varied than those seen by observers in the 17th century. Or again, after the assimilation of Franklin's paradigm, the electrician, looking at a Leyden jar, saw something different from what he had seen before. The device had become a condenser, for which neither the jar shape nor glass was required. Instead, the two conducting coatings, one of which had been no part of the original device, emerged to prominence. As both written discussions and pictorial representations gradually attest, two metal plates with a non-conductor between them had become the prototype for the class. Simultaneously, other inductive effects received new descriptions, and still others were noted for the first time. Shifts of this sort are not restricted to astronomy and electricity. We have already remarked some of the similar transformations of vision that can be drawn from the history of chemistry. Lavoisier, we said, saw oxygen where Priestley had seen dephlogisticated air, and where others had seen nothing at all. In learning to see oxygen, however, Lavoisier also had to change his view of many other, more familiar substances. He had, for example, to see a compound ore, where Priestley and his contemporaries had seen an elementary earth, and there were other such changes besides. At the very least, as a result of discovering oxygen, Lavoisier saw nature differently. And in the absence of some recourse to that hypothetical fixed nature that he saw differently, the principle of economy will urge us to say that after discovering oxygen, Lavoisier worked in a different world. I shall inquire in a moment about the possibility of avoiding this strange locution, but first we require an additional example of its use. This one deriving from one of the best-known parts of the work of Galileo. Since remote antiquity, most people have seen one or another heavy body swinging back and forth on a string or chain until it finally comes to rest. To the Aristotelians, who believed that a heavy body is moved by its own nature from a higher position to a state of natural rest at a lower one, the swinging body was simply falling with difficulty. Constrained by the chain, it could achieve rest at its low point only after a tortuous motion and a considerable time. Galileo, on the other hand, looking at the swinging body, saw a pendulum, a body that almost succeeded in repeating the same motion over and over again ad infinitum. And having seen that much, Galileo observed other properties of the pendulum as well, and constructed many of the most significant and original parts of his new dynamics around them. From the properties of the pendulum, for example, Galileo derived his only full and sound arguments for the independence of weight and rate of fall, as well as for the relationship between vertical height and terminal velocity of motions down inclined planes. All these natural phenomena he saw differently from the way they had been seen before. Why did that shift of vision occur? Through Galileo's individual genius, of course. But note that genius does not here manifest itself in more accurate or objective observation of the swinging body. Descriptively, the Aristotelian perception is just as accurate. When Galileo reported that the pendulum's period was independent of amplitude for amplitudes as great as 90 degrees, his view of the pendulum led him to see far more regularity than we can now discover there. Rather, what seems to have been involved was the exploitation by genius of perceptual possibilities made available by a medieval paradigm shift. Galileo was not raised completely as an Aristotelian. On the contrary, he was trained to analyze motions in terms of the impetus theory, a late medieval paradigm which held that the continuing motion of a heavy body is due to an internal power, implanted in it by the projector that initiated its motion. Jean Buridan and Nicole Orem, the 14th century scholastics who brought the impetus theory to its most perfect formulations, are the first men known to have seen, in oscillatory motions, any part of what Galileo saw there. Buridan describes the motion of a vibrating string as one in which impetus is first implanted when the string is struck. The impetus is next consumed in displacing the string against the resistance of its tension. Tension then carries the string back, implanting increasing impetus until the midpoint of motion is reached. After that, the impetus displaces the string in the opposite direction, again against the string's tension, and so on in a symmetric process that may continue indefinitely. Later in the century, Orem sketched a similar analysis of the swinging stone in what now appears as the first discussion of a pendulum. His view is clearly very close to the one with which Galileo first approached the pendulum. At least in Orem's case, and almost certainly in Galileo's as well. It was a view made possible by the transition from the original Aristotelian to the scholastic impetus paradigm for motion. Until that scholastic paradigm was invented, there were no pendulums, but only swinging stones for the scientist to see. Pendulums were brought into existence by something very like a paradigm-induced gestalt switch. Do we, however, really need to describe what separates Galileo from Aristotle or Lavoisier from Priestley as a transformation of vision? Did these men really see different things when looking at the same sorts of objects? Is there any legitimate sense in which we can say that they pursued their research in different worlds? Those questions can no longer be postponed, for there is obviously another, and far more usual, way to describe all of the historical examples outlined above. Many listeners will surely want to say that what changes with a paradigm is only the scientist's interpretation of observations that themselves are fixed, once and for all, by the nature of the environment and of the perceptual apparatus. On this view, Priestley and Lavoisier both saw oxygen, but they interpreted their observations differently. Aristotle and Galileo both saw pendulums, but they differed in their interpretations of what they both had seen. Let me say at once that this very usual view of what occurs when scientists change their minds about fundamental matters can be neither all wrong nor a mere mistake. Rather, it is an essential part of a philosophical paradigm initiated by Descartes and developed at the same time as Newtonian dynamics. That paradigm has served both science and philosophy well. Its exploitation, like that of dynamics itself, has been fruitful of a fundamental understanding that perhaps could not have been achieved in another way. But as the example of Newtonian dynamics also indicates, even the most striking past success provides no guarantee that crisis can be indefinitely postponed. Today, research in parts of philosophy, psychology, linguistics, and even art history all converge to suggest that the traditional paradigm is somehow askew. That failure to fit is also made increasingly apparent by the historical study of science, to which most of our attention is necessarily directed here. None of these crisis-promoting subjects has yet produced a viable alternate to the traditional epistemological paradigm, but they do begin to suggest what some of that paradigm's characteristics will be. I am, for example, acutely aware of the difficulties created by saying that when Aristotle and Galileo looked at swinging stones, the first saw constrained fall, the second a pendulum. The same difficulties are presented in an even more fundamental form by the opening sentences of this section. Though the world does not change with a change of paradigm, the scientist afterward works in a different world. Nevertheless, I am convinced that we must learn to make sense of statements that at least resemble these. What occurs during a scientific revolution is not fully reducible to a reinterpretation of individual and stable data. In the first place, the data are not unequivocally stable. A pendulum is not a falling stone, nor is oxygen dephlogisticated air. Consequently, the data that scientists collect from these diverse objects are, as we shall shortly see, themselves different. More important, the process by which either the individual or the community makes the transition from constrained fall to the pendulum or from dephlogisticated air to oxygen is not one that resembles interpretation. How could it do so in the absence of fixed data for the scientist to interpret? Rather than being an interpreter, the scientist who embraces a new paradigm is like the man wearing inverting lenses, confronting the same constellation of objects as before, and knowing that he does so, he nevertheless finds them transformed through and through in many of their details. None of these remarks is intended to indicate that scientists do not characteristically interpret observations and data. On the contrary, Galileo interpreted observations on the pendulum, Aristotle observations on falling stones, Musselbrook observations on a charge-filled bottle, and Franklin observations on a condenser. But each of these interpretations presupposed a paradigm. They were parts of normal science, an enterprise that, as we have already seen, aims to refine, extend, and articulate a paradigm that is already in existence. Section 3 provided many examples in which interpretation played a central role. Those examples typify the overwhelming majority of research. In each of them, the scientist, by virtue of an accepted paradigm, knew what a datum was, what instruments might be used to retrieve it, and what concepts were relevant to its interpretation. Given a paradigm, interpretation of data is central to the enterprise that explores it. But that interpretive enterprise, and this was the burden of the paragraph before last, can only articulate a paradigm, not correct it. Paradigms are not corrigible by normal science at all. Instead, as we have already seen, normal science ultimately leads only to the recognition of anomalies and to crises. And these are terminated not by deliberation and interpretation, but by a relatively sudden and unstructured event like the Gestalt switch. Scientists then often speak of the scales falling from the eyes or of the lightning flash that inundates a previously obscure puzzle, enabling its components to be seen in a new way that for the first time permits its solution. On other occasions, the relevant illumination comes in sleep. No ordinary sense of the term interpretation fits these flashes of intuition through which a new paradigm is born. Though such intuitions depend upon the experience, both anomalous and congruent, gained with the old paradigm, they are not logically or piecemeal linked to particular items of that experience as an interpretation would be. Instead, they gather up large portions of that experience and transform them to the rather different bundle of experience that will thereafter be linked, piecemeal, to the new paradigm, but not to the old. To learn more about what these differences in experience can be, return for a moment to Aristotle, Galileo, and the pendulum. What data did the interaction of their different paradigms and their common environment make accessible to each of them? Seeing constrained fall, the Aristotelian would measure, or at least discuss, the Aristotelian seldom measured, the weight of the stone, the vertical height to which it had been raised, and the time required for it to achieve rest. Together with the resistance of the medium, these were the conceptual categories deployed by Aristotelian science when dealing with a falling body. Normal research guided by them could not have produced the laws that Galileo discovered. It could only, and by another route it did, lead to the series of crises from which Galileo's view of the swinging stone emerged. As a result of those crises, and of other intellectual changes besides, Galileo saw the swinging stone quite differently. Archimedes' work on floating bodies made the medium non-essential. The impetus theory rendered the motion symmetrical and enduring, and Neoplatonism directed Galileo's attention to the motion's circular form. He therefore measured only weight, radius, angular displacement, and time per swing, which were precisely the data that could be interpreted to yield Galileo's laws for the pendulum. In the event, interpretation proved almost unnecessary. Given Galileo's paradigms, pendulum-like regularities were very nearly accessible to inspection. How else are we to account for Galileo's discovery that the bob's period is entirely independent of amplitude? A discovery that the normal science stemming from Galileo had to eradicate, and that we are quite unable to document today. Regularities that could not have existed for an Aristotelian, and that are, in fact, nowhere precisely exemplified by nature, were consequences of immediate experience for the man who saw the swinging stone as Galileo did. Perhaps that example is too fanciful, since the Aristotelians recorded no discussions of swinging stones. On their paradigm, it was an extraordinarily complex phenomenon. But the Aristotelians did discuss the simpler case, stones falling without uncommon constraints, and the same differences of vision are apparent there. Contemplating a falling stone, Aristotle saw a change of state rather than a process. For him, the relevant measures of emotion were therefore total distance covered and total time elapsed, parameters which yield what we should now call not speed, but average speed. Similarly, because the stone was impelled by its nature to reach its final resting point, Aristotle saw the relevant distance parameter at any instant during the motion as the distance to the final endpoint, rather than as that from the origin of motion. Those conceptual parameters underlie and give sense to most of his well-known laws of motion. Partly through the impetus paradigm, however, and partly through a doctrine known as the latitude of forms, scholastic criticism changed this way of viewing motion. A stone moved by impetus gained more and more of it while receding from its starting point. Distance from, rather than distance to, therefore became the relevant parameter. In addition, Aristotle's notion of speed was bifurcated by the scholastics into concepts that, soon after Galileo, became our average speed and instantaneous speed. But when seen through the paradigm of which these conceptions were a part, the falling stone, like the pendulum, exhibited its governing laws almost on inspection. Galileo was not one of the first men to suggest that stones fall with a uniformly accelerated motion. Furthermore, he had developed his theorem on this subject, together with many of its consequences, before he experimented with an inclined plane. That theorem was another one of the network of new regularities accessible to genius, in the world determined jointly by nature and by the paradigms upon which Galileo and his contemporaries had been raised. Living in that world, Galileo could still, when he chose, explain why Aristotle had seen what he did. Nevertheless, the immediate content of Galileo's experience with falling stones was not what Aristotle's had been. It is, of course, by no means clear that we need to be so concerned with immediate experience, that is, with the perceptual features that a paradigm so highlights, that they surrender their regularities almost upon inspection. Those features must obviously change with the scientists' commitments to paradigms, but they are far from what we ordinarily have in mind when we speak of the raw data or the brute experience from which scientific research is reputed to proceed. Perhaps immediate experience should be set aside as fluid, and we should discuss instead the concrete operations and measurements that the scientist performs in his laboratory. Or perhaps the analysis should be carried further still from the immediately given. It might, for example, be conducted in terms of some neutral observation language, perhaps one designed to conform to the retinal imprints that mediate what the scientist sees. Only in one of these ways can we hope to retrieve a realm in which experience is again stable once and for all, in which the pendulum and constrained fall are not different perceptions, but rather different interpretations of the unequivocal data provided by observation of a swinging stone. But is sensory experience fixed and neutral? Are theories simply man-made interpretations of given data? The epistemological viewpoint that has most often guided Western philosophy for three centuries dictates an immediate and unequivocal yes. In the absence of a developed alternative, I find it impossible to relinquish entirely that viewpoint. Yet it no longer functions effectively. And the attempts to make it do so, through the introduction of a neutral language of